Hi everyone, it's Nancy. We'd like to invite our listeners who are also fans of professional wrestling to tune in to Brainy Bird Media's newest podcast, You're Never Too Old to Watch Wrestling. It's the perfect show for those of us who are busy being grown-ups, but still want to keep up with the fun, funny world of wrestling. New episodes drop every Friday, and you can find You're Never Too Old to Watch Wrestling on iTunes, Stitcher, and most other applications for downloading podcasts. We'd also really appreciate it if you could go onto iTunes and review our shows. Just click iTunes and search the show titles, then leave us a review and some stars. It helps us grow and reach more listeners. Thank you. You either have a maid or you are one. For centuries, that was true. Until women entered the workforce en masse in the middle of the 20th century, most middle class and certainly all wealthy families employed domestic servants. Desperately poor, unskilled women of all ages, by the millions, worked long hours cooking, cleaning, and taking care of children, usually for barely subsistence wages. They were often cheated by their micromanaging mistresses and subjected to exploitation by the men of the house. In 1912, a quote, hired girl, unquote, with 33 years experience, wrote an anonymous letter to Outlook magazine in which she described very limited time off and bosses who regularly forgot or pretended to forget to pay her. Domestic servants had pretty much no legal protections enjoyed by other workers. They could be fired without cause, which left them homeless in addition to being unemployed. Or they could be summarily fired for such grievous offenses as eating food designated for the family, using an upstairs bathroom, or coming home late, even on their day off. Imagine what happened to them if it was discovered that they were carrying a contagious disease. Welcome to this special Witch Hunt podcast mini-series. We'd like to thank Creative Salem for supporting the podcast. Based in Salem, Massachusetts, Creative Salem is an organization of like-minded creative individuals with the mission of ensuring that creativity and the arts are a relevant part of daily community and small business life, and educating people on the importance of arts and creativity in the community. Born in Ireland in 1869, Mary Mallon was part of a wave of Irish immigrants who arrived in the United States in the latter part of the 19th century. Arriving in New York in 1883, Mallon, like many other struggling new arrivals, particularly single women, found work as a domestic servant. It's likely that she started out as a housemaid, whose jobs were to clean, do laundry, and pitch in cooking, serving, and providing daycare as needed. Job descriptions for domestic servants in Mary Mallon's day were, to put it nicely, fluid. You were basically at the mercy of your boss and his or her demands. Popular TV series like Downton Abbey or its predecessor Upstairs Downstairs peered dramatically into the drawing rooms of the 1% of the late 19th and early 20th century and the retinue of servants who attended them. However, both shows really only skimmed the surface of how hard life was for servants. For a more realistic glimpse into life as a domestic servant at the time period we're talking about, I recommend the PBS series Manor House, in which a group of modern people attempt to recreate life above and below stairs in an Edwardian manor house. One lesson aristocrats learned very early on was to never say thank you to a servant. Instead, you would nod your head in acknowledgement. Otherwise, all you'd be doing all day is saying thank you to people who are supposed to be invisible. A servant's day was typically at least 12 hours long, and the concept of the weekend did not exist. You might get a few hours off on Sundays, or perhaps one evening a week when you didn't have to be on call. Sick days or vacation time to visit family were all subject to the needs and whims of your employer. As a domestic servant, Mary Mallon was additionally required to observe strict standards of behavior. For example, if she were to run into a member of the family or one of their guests, she would have been required to try to make herself invisible, turn to the wall, keep her hands close to her sides, and under no circumstances speak to them, not even to say good morning. Servants were forbidden from speaking unless spoken to, and offering an opinion on anything could mean immediate dismissal without a reference. Curfews were strictly imposed, even during an evening free. Servants were not allowed to invite friends or family to visit them in the servants' quarters without the permission of the housekeeper or the butler. Female servants were forbidden to smoke, and any servant caught fraternizing with another servant of the opposite sex would be fired on the spot. In exchange, servants who typically came from desperately poor circumstances were provided with a place to live, regular meals, and a small salary. At a time when there were no social safety nets for people living in poverty, consistent food, shelter, and a few dollars were not inconsiderable enticements to work under less than ideal conditions. There's not a lot known about Mary Mallon's early years in Ireland or in New York, but we know at some point she began working as a cook and was apparently a very good one. Successful cooks worked extremely long hours, typically in hot, airless kitchens, but they also earned more money and garnered more respect in a house than, say, a parlor maid. Mallon, who was described as a tall, imposing woman, would have remained one of the anonymous millions who toiled away for the rich, but for one weird and awful fact of her life. Wherever Mary Mallon cooked, people got typhoid. Well, that's not exactly fair. Wherever we know Mary Mallon cooked, people got typhoid. When someone at work gets sick and we start calling them Typhoid Mary and urging bottles of hand sanitizer on them, it's a sad homage to Mary Mallon. She's the original Typhoid Mary. Typhoid is an old-sounding ailment, but it's still around. It's a bacterial infection that is transmitted by direct contact with the feces of an infected person. In other words, when somebody with typhoid bacterium in their system cooks and serves food after going to the bathroom and not washing their hands thoroughly. In 2015, the most recent years that the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has records, there were 30 recorded outbreaks of typhoid fever in the U.S., in which 411 people got sick. 46 required hospitalization. Fortunately, no one died. When properly treated and diagnosed with antibiotics, typhoid is nearly always curable. Left untreated, it kills 1 in 4. Typhoid is estimated to have killed more than 80,000 soldiers during the American Civil War, and even today, when antibiotics and a typhoid vaccine are available in the developed world, the World Health Organization reports that every year, 21 million people contract typhoid fever, and about 220,000 die. Symptoms of typhoid fever are a high fever, a rash, a headache, and stomach pain. The development and use of antibiotics to treat typhoid wouldn't be available until 2 decades after Mary Mallon's tenure as a cook for the rich. In the summer of 1906, Mallon took a job cooking in the kitchen of an Oyster Bay, Long Island summer home rented by New York banker Charles Henry Warren. Including servants, there were 11 people in the home, and by late August, 6 of them came down with typhoid fever. George Sopper, a civil engineer, was hired by the Long Island homeowners to uncover the source of contamination. Sopper had a reputation as a fairly competent epidemiologist in the analysis of typhoid fever epidemics. In Oyster Bay, Sopper moved quickly and ruled out contaminated clams, water, or milk. After questioning staff and family, he learned that a few weeks before the outbreak, the family had hired a new cook, a woman named Mary Mallon. Mallon had quit and left the job about 3 weeks after people started getting sick. Relying on records provided by employment agencies with which Mary Mallon was registered, Sopper traced the available records and found that wherever Mary went, typhoid fever seemed to follow. A common misperception of Mary Mallon is that she was responsible for an epidemic that killed scores of people, and that's simply not true. Known records show that throughout the course of her life, Mallon may have infected about 50 people, 3 of whom unfortunately died. After leaving the job in Long Island, Mallon headed back to New York City and was working for the Bowen family of Park Avenue, where a chambermaid came down with typhoid and where George Sopper tracked Mallon down. Their first and subsequent meetings were less than cordial. Sopper doesn't appear to have exercised much tact when approaching Mary Mallon and trying to communicate with her what he believed was happening. We don't have a transcript of their initial conversations, or maybe I should say initial confrontations, but based on my research, I imagine it went something like this. Sopper shows up unannounced, uninvited, in the kitchen where Mary is working, and tells her that she has typhoid and is spreading death and disease wherever she goes. "You need to come with me right now," he tells her, "so I can test samples of your blood and feces and keep you from killing more people." Needless to say, she didn't take it well. She threw him out of the house, allegedly chasing him off with a carving fork. It didn't make sense to her. Mallon wasn't sick. She was healthy, and that's true. Mallon was what is called an asymptomatic carrier, or a healthy carrier. In other words, Mary carried typhoid bacterium in her body and could transmit it to others, but she herself didn't get sick. Until her death of pneumonia in 1938, Mallon insisted that she was healthy as a horse and had never had typhoid fever. And indeed, it's possible that Mallon contracted a mild case of typhoid that she may have written off as just not feeling well for a few days. Nevertheless, Mallon was a carrier, even if she didn't believe it or willingly acknowledge it. Sopper convinced New York City health officials that Mary Mallon was a danger to the public, and she was forcibly taken into custody and sent first to the Willard Park Hospital in New York City. Testing revealed high concentrations of typhoid in her feces. Mallon was kept in custody and moved to an isolation cottage on the grounds of Riverside Hospital on North Brother Island. North Brother Island is a 20-acre island in New York's East River between the Bronx and Rikers Island. Officials commandeered it as a quarantine station in the 1880s. The hospital there was used to house veterans after World War II and as a treatment center for teenagers addicted to heroin in the 50s and early 1960s. It closed permanently in 1963 and has been left to decay ever since. After 3 years of arguing that she was healthy and being unfairly isolated, Mallon did what any savvy American would do. She hired a lawyer and sued the Department of Health. It worked. The judge sided with Mallon, and in 1910, she was set free, but with one caveat. Under no circumstances was Mary Mallon to go back to work as a cook. Sopper and others vowed to try to help Mallon find a way to make a living outside of the kitchen. Their efforts were not successful. The low-paying jobs, such as working at a laundry, were an enormous step down for somebody like Mary Mallon, who'd commanded a kitchen and a decent salary as a talented cook. Mary Mallon was known, at least by name. Newspaper articles called her a killer and a menace to society. A famous drawing depicted her cracking skulls into a frying pan as if she were cooking up death for breakfast. What happens next is hard to explain or to understand. Maybe she genuinely didn't believe she could infect people with typhoid fever. Or maybe she was just so fed up and angry with the world after years of isolation and poverty that she just didn't care. But whatever the case, Mary Mallon in 1915 began using an alias, Mary Brown, and went back to work as a cook. That same year, an outbreak of typhoid fever at Manhattan's Sloan Maternity Hospital sickened 25 workers and killed two. The hospital's cook was a woman named Mary Brown, who, the story goes, went along with her co-workers' jokes that she was the infamous Typhoid Mary. Imagine their shock when New York health authorities and police officers showed up at the hospital to take her into custody because she really was Typhoid Mary. Mary Mallon was returned to Brothers Island and remained there until her death. She's a difficult character to place when thinking about why we get mad at people for getting sick. On one hand, it's not hard to have compassion for a poor, working woman just trying to do an honest job and support herself. On the other hand, after years of testing, including having a lab do testing that she paid for herself, Madeline must have at least had some suspicion that she could spread disease. At this point, I wish I had more hands, because there's also the fact that Mary Madeline wasn't the only carrier of typhoid fever in New York City who was healthy, not by a long shot. She was just the first one, and because of that, she was locked up and isolated for years. Historian and retired professor Judith Walter Levitt is the author of a wonderful book, Typhoid Mary, Captive to the Public Health. Dr. Levitt was a professor of history, and specifically the history of medicine, as well as the history of science and women's studies at the University of Wisconsin. She spoke to us about how, even a century later, Mary Madeline's case illustrates the ways that society turns against people when they get sick, and how difficult it can be to balance the needs of society to protect itself from contagious diseases while still respecting individual rights.
I know that you wrote a wonderful book about the infamous Typhoid Mary. One of the things that I wanted to ask you was, what first got you interested in Mary Madeline, better known as Typhoid Mary?
I taught a course on the history of public health in the United States at the University of Wisconsin. And one of the issues that I always discussed was Mary Madeline and the issues that she raised. The issue that interested me the most was the question of how you protect individual personal liberty at the same time as you protect the public health, if those two things come into conflict, which they did in her case. So I used to teach about her, and no historian had really written her story, so I wrote it.
When you were teaching the class on her, if you had just said, has anybody ever heard of Mary Madeline, how many hands do you think would have gone up?
Used to start my lectures with that question, actually. The older people in an audience would have heard of her, and the younger ones, they think that she's the name of a rock band.
I'm wondering if you had asked, do you know who Mary Madeline is, how many hands would have gone up, versus have you heard of Typhoid Mary?
Oh, right. Yeah, most people had not heard of Mary Madeline, and a lot of the people who had heard the phrase Typhoid Mary did not know if it was about a real person or a fictional person.
One of the things that's sort of, fascinating is that she wasn't by a long shot the only healthy carrier of typhoid in New York City, but she seems to be the only one who was locked up for it. How do you think her story...
That's not quite true. There were others that were locked up temporarily. She was the only long-term one who was isolated. And I think part of the reason for that is that she was the first one to be identified. Maybe they thought they were making an example out of her.
Do you think they might have made an example of her if she had, say, been the daughter of a wealthy industrialist?
Probably not. I do think who she was and what she stood for, what she represented, that is immigrants, single women, had a lot to do with how she was treated. I think if the first healthy carrier had been a richer woman, first of all, her family would have gotten her a lawyer, and the lawyer might have gotten at least some due process into the mix. I think a richer woman would have been respected more than Mary Madeline was. So, yeah, I think there would have been differences, and I think it definitely mattered who she was and that the health department thought she was expendable in some way.
What today, even, in 2017 and moving forward, what are some of the most common misperceptions that people have about Mary Madeline?
Well, I think we still think of her as somebody who did this maliciously, who was an evil person and who infected people maliciously. And I think the phrase Typhoid Mary is a negative one. Nobody wants to be a Typhoid Mary. I think the fact that that has been identified with her and followed her has been very long lasting. I tried in my book to take her side and to see if I could understand this whole story from her perspective. And, I think I do in many ways. And that is that here she is, a hardworking immigrant woman, making a living, but not a great living, but proud of her work, kind woman. People described her always as someone who is nice to the family, nice to the kids in the families that she cooked for. Proud of her work, and she's ripped out of that world and put out on an island by herself. And it's just, she didn't want to accept that. And her way of seeing it was to understand that there are two kinds of justice in America, one for the rich and one for the poor. And she understood that she was not getting a fair shake.
You were saying that she has this reputation for being very nice to the families that she worked for. But I mean, if you were a domestic servant in the late 19th century, early 20th century, you had very little agency over your life.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I would say she had very little, but she didn't think she had none, and she wanted to keep what she did have. Life as a domestic was hard, but the cook was the highest on the domestic ring, so that you could have a housekeeper who would do, you know, cleaning out the fireplaces and cleaning the house, whereas the cook would have much more status among the domestics and even within the family because her food was so important to them.
And they made more money.
And she made more money, exactly.
Your book draws some really meaningful parallels between the experiences of typhoid outbreaks and at least the early days of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Can you explain a little bit about what you found the commonality between these epidemics?
Well, I think contagious disease is frightening for our world today and in the past. And we tend to think that we can tamp it down by finding the so-called guilty individual and making them stop. We did that with HIV/AIDS. We found a scapegoat, and we thought that that would help us solve the epidemic. With Ebola, I think we have also made scapegoats out of the people in Africa who were suffering from the disease. So I think we sort of have a proclivity to look for blame outside of ourselves and usually ascribe it to people who are marginalized on the social edges, who we think are somewhat expendable. So I think that has been true for, that was true for Mary Mallon, and I think it's true for other epidemics that we have faced. Now, I don't want to suggest that we should never, ever isolate anybody. I think in the name of public health, sometimes we're going to have to do that. My concern is that we shouldn't do it first, unless it's an unbelievably scary, very quick-moving epidemic, that the only way to stop it is to isolate people very quickly.
The Witch Hunt podcast is written by me, Nancy Matus Bird, and produced by Dan Bird. Thank you to Cody Dexter for our theme music and to Adam Dreyfuss for our logo. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the upcoming fabulous season 2 of the Witch Hunt podcast, send an email to producer Dan Bird at dan@brainybirdmedia.com. And that's spelled Brainy Bird with a Y. You can follow us online at brainybirdmedia.com/witchhuntpodcast and on Facebook at Witch Hunt Podcast, on Instagram at Witch Hunt Podcast, and on our Twitter feed, Witch Hunt Pod. You can also email us at witchhuntpodcast@gmail.com. We hope you'll join us next for the final episode of this special mini-series, Paper Plates and Sympathy. We'll talk about what it is about sick people that drives us to fear and sometimes anger. Why does compassion too often escape us just when we need it the most?